From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, as the government shutdown drags on, federal workers in Massachusetts pay the price.
My husband is the sole earner. I'm disabled. So this is really affecting us, and they all need to do their job so my husband can do his.
We'll hear from former Congressman Michael Capuano on the shutdown and what Democrats should do to end it. Also today, Attorney General Maura Healey takes on Purdue Pharma and its owners for their alleged role in the opioid epidemic.
We will hold opioid makers accountable for the role they played in creating this crisis.
And could Boston's new Chinese-made subway cars be spying on us?
And I know it's weird. It sounds like I thought of a Tom Clancy novel. But if there hasn't been so many other instances of the Chinese government actively doing this that have been caught, you know there are countless others.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
They say shut down. We want to work. They say shut down.
Day 27, your government held hostage. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In Boston today, federal employees and their supporters rallied outside the State House demanding the government reopen. 800,000 workers across the country, over 8,000 here in Massachusetts, are off the job, not being paid. Many are working without pay. A while ago, we talked to two people directly affected by the shutdown, Danielle and Ramesh Vyas, who live paycheck to paycheck in Lowell. Ramesh works for the IRS, is heading back to work without pay. They have three teenage children. Danielle is disabled and stays at home and says the shutdown is hurting the entire family.
It is affecting us extremely hard. We have been unable to pay our rent. Our bills are piling up. We actually have a 14-day notice to quit. Because of non-payment, we've been reaching out to Representative Lori Trahan's office and trying to, you know, work with our property management. But so far, what they're saying is they can accept, you know, a letter explaining our situation, but they have to go through the process.
So when you say notice to quit, does that mean notice to evict?
No, it's the right before the eviction process.
So
we have to pay before the 24th or else they'll start eviction proceedings.
Right. Now, Ramesh, can you describe a little bit your experience working for the IRS now without pay? How are you coping with this?
It's very difficult. With me, it's very difficult because we go paycheck by paycheck, and paycheck is still not even making it. It's been affecting really bad. I got a little bit weak with that, a little sick too. And my mentality is affected. I'm like feeling like too much frustrated type situation.
Yeah, I understand, and I'm really sorry to hear that. Danielle, I understand you have three teenagers. How is this situation affecting them?
Well, we're trying to make it less, but, you know, my husband, when he spoke with the congressional delegation last week, he was in our local newspaper, he was on TV. So, you know, we can't hide the fact that we're in such financial trouble. But it's hard looking at your children and them worrying about, are we going to get kicked out of our apartment?
Yeah. Now, as we know, President Trump, a few weeks back, he asked debt collectors and landlords to go, in his words, nice and easy on unpaid federal workers, and said he's sure people will make adjustments. They always do. What's your reaction to that? Has that been the case for you? It doesn't sound like it has been.
To be honest to you, I gone through every single day are too many people, my union president, United Way, and a couple other people coordinating and stuff like that. In a practical sense, only the experience, I can say that I had a good experience with day before yesterday with the local Lowell SNAP benefit people. They were positive and helpful. But beside that, we were unable to reach to unemployment people. We were unable to reach easily to anyone, and everybody trying to help. But in a real sense, nothing is coming in a plate.
Danielle, who do you ultimately blame for this? Is it President Trump? Is it the Republicans? Is it the Democrats? How do you think about who's responsible and why we're in this situation 27 days on?
I think that they're all at fault, but right now I see Mitch McConnell. Because if he allows a vote in the Senate, then we can see. And that we can see how many Republicans want to continue this shutdown. Shutdowns are not popular, usually, with the Republican Party. But as long as he keeps it off the table, then there's going to be no negotiation. I think they're all at fault. I don't agree with the way that the Democrats are not getting into details. Why don't you not support this wall? Because there is no clear plan? Because, you know, there needs to be some more done by everyone. Because we're running around doing everything we can to just stay afloat. And we see online that there's some people in the general public that really don't understand that federal workers aren't this privileged class of people, that we also, you know, have financial troubles and you know, work. My husband is the sole earner. I'm disabled. So this is really affecting us, and they all need to do their job so my husband can do his.
Well, Danielle and Ramesh, I'm, again, incredibly sorry that you're in this situation. Thank you for sharing your story with us. We're very grateful.
Thank you for getting the word out. We appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Danielle and Ramesh Vyas of Lowell. Ramesh works for the IRS, and they were talking to us about the government shutdown now in day 27. For more on the shutdown and what it means politically, let's turn now to Michael Capuano, the former congressman who represented the 7th Congressional District. He's with us in the studio, and good to see you, Michael Capuano. Thanks for coming back to Radio Boston.
Always a pleasure, Anthony.
So when you hear stories like the ones we just heard from Danielle and Ramesh Vyas, what's your reaction?
Heard them all the time, and every word they said, it rings true, and it's heart-wrenching. Hundreds of thousands of people who have done absolutely nothing wrong, actually done most everything right, just want to go to work and just want to put a paycheck on their table. So it is heart-wrenching. They are the victims. Well, they are the first victims in this situation. There are also victims that cannot be found because their people are not getting the services that they would otherwise get.
Right. We heard Danielle say she blames both Republicans and Democrats. You're a partisan. I'm sure you would take issue with President Trump and the Republicans. But are you concerned at all that the Democrats could be doing more to work toward a compromise?
I'm not so sure they could be doing more, but it does raise the question, why didn't Trump pull this hard stunt when the Republicans did control the House and the Senate? In theory, he's had 2 years to get his wall by Republican domination. And the fact that he's doing it now certainly raises the question as to why did he wait until Democrats took the House back?
Yeah.
So I think that's an important factor. At the same time, when every day that goes by, more and more people are going to just blame everybody. They're just going to get mad at everybody. And I don't necessarily blame them. And I've actually been waiting for one side or the other to start public negotiations. I have no idea. No one has any idea whether there's any real negotiations going on behind the scenes. I hope there are. But whether there are or there are not, I think the first person who comes out with a reasonable proposal for a compromise I think might have a chance of, quote, winning, for the lack of a better word. I mean, I don't know that anyone has come out of this, but at least not losing as much as the other side.
Right. Well, Speaker Pelosi was asked today about how much money she'd agree to pay for Trump's border wall. Here's how she responded.
But do you need to express more willingness to negotiate on that figure for Republicans to get past this
idea? I'm not for a wall. I'm not for a wall.
I'm not for a wall. So comment on this. I mean, my take on this is the wall, obviously a very powerful symbol for Trump and his base. But it seems like the Democrats are at risk of sort of making I'm not for a wall and absolutely no wall just as much of a symbol for them that they don't want to back away from.
Well, I think the average person would put that particular aspect in perspective. Nobody in their right mind really thinks a wall is the answer. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you're right, it has become a symbol on both sides in the sense that, first of all, it'll never be a wall. It was never going to be a wall, but mm-hmm. some kind of a fence or whatever it might be, or some sort of barrier. At the same time, again, I think if Trump were to come out tomorrow and say, OK, instead of $5 billion, I'll accept $2.5 billion, and in return, I'll take care of the kids who are threatened with DACA, and I'll take care of the temporary protective status or whatever. That, you know, there's 1,000 different options here. I think that the American people would see that as the first step towards a compromise. And I think the Democrats could do the same thing and say, look, we don't like the wall, which we don't. Pretty clear, pretty obvious. We've made the point. But for the sake of getting the government back open, we will make a compromise. And this is what we'll do. We don't want a wall, but we'll accept a fence. We'll give you a little bit of it so you can do 100 mile, whatever, something. Mm-hmm. And I actually think the first person that comes up with some sort of a reasonable offer, even if it's not real, even if it's not done in private, it's only done in public for the purposes of moving the public, I think they're going to get a lot of credit for that.
Well, we should hear what President Trump has said recently about this. Here he is speaking recently at the Pentagon.
While many Democrats in the House and Senate would like to make a deal, Speaker Pelosi will not let them negotiate. The party has been hijacked by the open borders fringe within the party, the radical left becoming the radical Democrats.
That's President Trump speaking this morning at the Pentagon. What do you think? Is there
That's the opposite of trying to reach a deal. That's taking somebody and just throwing oil, gasoline on the fire. I mean, that's ridiculous. I have never heard anybody tell me that open borders is the answer. It's offensive. It's clearly done for partisan purposes. And again, I go back to what I just said earlier. Had he come out today and said, look, I want a $5 billion wall. I don't like what the Democrats are doing. They won't negotiate. Here's my since I can't get them to come to the White House, here's my opening proposal. Now, again, he might get some grief from some of the extreme people on the right who want nothing but a wall. There are people that want no wall at all. Most of us would say, look, I'm one of them. I don't want a wall. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of money. But there are plenty of wastes of money in the world. I thought that some of the aircraft carriers we built was a waste of money.
Bigger waste of money, actually.
And some people on the other side think that some of the social programs we do are a waste of money.
Right.
And it's if you want to get things back rolling in the right direction, you're going to have to compromise. Admit it's a compromise. It's not what I want, not what we want. If everybody just sits in their corner and says, I'm not going to do anything unless I get what I want, it makes it very difficult for the other side to move.
Yeah, and now we've reached a point. I mean, to me, it just seems absurd. So Nancy Pelosi is now suggesting to President Trump, we're going to postpone the State of the Union address because we're worried about security. Either postpone it or you can mail it in. And this afternoon, we learned that President Trump has now said to Nancy Pelosi, you can't have a military aircraft to do your overseas trip that was planned. What do you make of this?
It seems to be getting worse instead of better.
Yeah.
And again, at some point, the adults will have to become public. And again, my hope and presumption is that there are some behind-the-scenes negotiations going on. My hope is that tomorrow they come out and say, look, we made a deal. Here's the compromise we made. And they're both going to claim victory. We win this for this reason. We win for that reason. There's no way for us to know that, whether that's happening, and no way for me to know that. I just think if, as a political person, I just think that most of America, maybe not any particular constituent, no one person, but I think the vast majority of people would have their opinions, but will accept a compromise on this, like most things.
Yeah. So we were struck by this new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll out today that the president's approval ratings are down significantly to 39%. He's lost 10 approval points with Republicans. He's lost with his base. And the Times reported yesterday that the president told his acting chief of staff, we are getting crushed. Why can't we get a deal? I mean, I guess where I'm going with this question is it looks like at least for now that the public holds the president and the Republicans more responsible for this. But is there a risk that if the Democrats sort of hold on to this idea or their position, that this could hurt their standing eventually?
There's always a risk. And Trump's polls have gone up and down from day one. I mean, he's about as mercurial as you can get. Hmm. The kind of things you just quoted a few minutes ago, but what he said today, that doesn't help his approval rating because, again, I think any normal person would see that as simply throwing gasoline on the fire. And that's not generally what people want in their leaders. They want more thoughtful people that are a little bit more steady. All that being said, do Democrats run a risk? Of course they do. Right now, the risk is running in their favor. But then again, life and politics are both full of risks. And if you're not willing to take one, you really shouldn't be in public life.
I want to ask you a little bit about the latest in the Russia investigation and what you're seeing there, and what looks like more and more evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And recently we learned Paul Manafort discussed a peace plan for Ukraine with a longtime associate who had a connection to the Kremlin. He also shared political data with political polling data with him. Then even Rudolph Giuliani, the president's attorney, isn't denying that it looks like the campaign colluded with Russia, although he's walked that back since yesterday. But does this look like what does this look like to you? I mean,
it looks like collusion. I mean, there's a fair question. I hasn't been answered yet whether Donald Trump himself knew or participated in it.
Right, I guess
but
that's the
there's
question.
No question that somebody in the campaign colluded with it. To be perfectly honest, that's an important issue. Don't get me wrong. But I think the cover-up has become more important because, look, if you make a mistake, sit up and say, you know, I didn't realize I wasn't supposed to talk to the Russians during a campaign. Sorry, won't do it again. It doesn't make it right. It just, okay. I don't think the average person would know where the line is when it comes to dealing with a foreign government in the middle of a campaign when you can't really do anything about it. There's other questions about why were they colluding, not just to win a campaign. There's questions about whether there is undue influence on the existing administration. I think that's a way more important than colluding about an election. Now, that's bad and that's wrong and it should be held to account. But if the Russian government has something on either the president or people in his administration now, that's an ongoing inappropriate influence.
What should Democrats in Congress do about this? Many, of course, want to push for investigations. They will. Some want to push for impeachment. That remains to be seen if that happens. If you were still in Congress, what would you be counseling your fellow Democrats?
Exactly what I think they're going to do. They're going to be reviewing every aspect of all these allegations and see where it goes. I think, again, the adults in the room are saying, you know, you can't jump to a conclusion. We wouldn't want anybody else doing it. Why should we do it? But we are now going to ask legitimate questions and get legitimate answers. And if they lead to a place where there should be impeachment, we'll get there when we get there.
Hmm. Just in the minute or so that remains, I'd love to ask you really quickly about what your take is on this these very early stages of a presidential campaign that's taking shape. Elizabeth Warren's been out to Iowa. She's been in New Hampshire. Julian Castro, Kristen Gillibrand, Beto O'Rourke, Joe Biden, possibly. So looking at 2020, what are you seeing there in terms of the contours of this presidential race from the Democratic side?
Look, it's starting to look like we're going to have the same thing Republicans had 4 years ago, which is a huge field that'll winnow itself down over time one way or another. It will be different because some different states are a little bit – they've changed their timing, California being the most notable. But the concept is still the same. The American public will have a say in the matter. Now, I know there was talk. I don't think it's going to happen. I would love to get rid of caucus states. I believe strongly and vehemently in primaries, letting every person who can go out and have that voice, as opposed to only the most committed. At a caucus, it sounds fine until you know the details. In a primary, you go in, you vote, takes you 20 minutes or whatever it takes you to get to the polls. And a caucus could take you 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours if you have to stay there.
And you might have to drive a couple hours.
And you may cast your vote and then you leave because I'm done. I did my job. I'm done. And it tends to end up in only the most committed people who stick around. Again, that's a pipe dream at the moment. I don't think it's going to happen. But I do think I know that there are several fewer caucus states this time than there were the last time. Not enough, as far as I'm concerned. But I think it's going to be fun. It's going to be educational. It's going to make the media very happy because you'll have lots to talk about for quite a while.
It's already started.
and it's going to get worse or better, depending how you look at it.
Do you have let me ask you specifically about Elizabeth Warren, who's made corruption in Washington and sort of the way it relates to the hollowing out of the middle class. Sort of a two-part question. First of all, do you have someone this early on in the process that you're backing? And what do you think about that particular message?
No, I don't have anybody yet. I firmly believe you don't get involved unless there's a specific reason until you know what the field is and the real serious field, not just those who are investigating or in, I forget the term for
exploratory
exploring.
Committee.
Exploring.
Right. Yeah.
Let's see who's actually in and who can actually do it. For me, yeah. Beating Donald Trump is the most important question.
Right.
And that electability to me is probably the top issue for anybody. As far as I'm concerned, I think everybody's going to try to get their carving of the message. You're going to have, within reason, I think you're going to have a pretty broad spectrum of people with from a philosophical viewpoint on the Democratic side. You won't have the extreme right because we don't have them too much in the party. But you're going to go from a Tulsi Gabbard to an Elizabeth Warren, you know, and Joe Biden in the middle. And people can say, oh, it's a fight for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. That's right. It is. That's exactly what a primary is.
That's what a primary is, right.
And at the end of the day, I hope that most of us understand that if your candidate doesn't win, you still have to look at the two that are left. One of them are going to be president, either a Democrat or probably Donald Trump. I assume he'll run for re-election and get nominated. Which one is better? Not which one is perfect. Which one is better? And I think we had some trouble the last election with that. I'm hoping and praying that we have less trouble with that this time.
Well, as you said, there's going to be lots to talk about. We're happy to talk about this with you. So thank you for coming in today.
Thanks,
Michael
Anthony.
Capuano. That's former Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano. Stay with us. Coming up, could those Chinese-made tea cars be spying on us? We're going to talk about that. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. It may sound like the plot of a Mission Impossible movie, subway cars made by the Chinese government spying on us. But experts say it's not only possible, it could be happening right now. In Massachusetts, the MBTA has awarded more than $840 million in contracts to the China Railway Rolling Stock Corporation, a state-owned enterprise, to build about 400 new subway cars for the T. State Representative Sean Dooley, a Norfolk Republican, is warning they could be a Trojan horse. Writing in Commonwealth Magazine, Dooley says, it's clear the MBTA didn't consider what it means for the safety of riders and their personal information when it agreed to become a client of the Chinese government. And Representative Sean Dooley is with us right now. Welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly are you worried about that could be happening with the T's new red and orange line cars?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, as you said, it sounds like something out of a Tom Clancy novel. But the reality is China has been a bad actor for a long time as far as stealing technology. And most recently with the Marriott data breach, with the ZTE chip spyware. I'm worried about them having control of our rail. I mean, it is a national security issue. Having our rail being manufactured by a foreign government, we would never let them manufacture an aircraft carrier or a fighter plane. Why are we letting them have something so complicated and so important?
But, you know, I was just mentioning, I want to give credit to Michael Capuano, because just a moment ago he said, you know, what are you talking about in the next segment? And I said this and I explained. And he said, well, then we got to be worrying about every single cell phone and TV set and, you know, every piece of equipment in our kitchen, et cetera. You get the point. I mean, so much stuff is assembled in China. Are you concerned that all of this could be full of spyware?
Well, obviously, there's been instances, you know, in Canada where they had the ZTE breach. That is the problem. But I'm more worried from the standpoint of this is a major security infrastructure. I mean, if there is technology built into the rail cars, they can take it over. They can shut down our rail system. They can control the engines. And, you know, in a case of war or espionage, you know, have horrific events. So it's not just spying and getting our personal information. It's also being able to either shut down our rail or manipulate our rail and kind of hold us hostage.
So we reached out to the MBTA and they sent us a statement last night. I'm just going to read part of it. This comes from the MBTA. The safety of the T's systems is of the utmost importance, and the MBTA has robust controls in place to maintain the security of the system. They also say the software components of the new rail cars aren't being made in China and they're built consistent with cybersecurity guidelines of the Department of Defense's military system safety standards. Does that make you feel a little bit better?
Oh, that makes me feel a little bit better. But, you know, different cybersecurity people I've spoken to, they're like, there are Trojan horses. You know, they are doing all the wiring. They are doing all the other infrastructure aspects of these rail cars, and they could have something in there that it's not activated now. It could be activated later. And that's what we're really worried about, it because, you know, once it's into the infrastructure, it can transfer into more, you know, comprehensive components.
Hmm. Well, Representative Lee, stand by, because I want to introduce Andrew Grotto of Stanford University. He's a former senior director for cybersecurity policy in the Obama administration and the Trump administration as well. And Andrew Grotto, welcome to Radio Boston. It's good to have you.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you've been listening in to what Representative Dooley is concerned about. Is he way out there, or are his concerns justified? What do you think?
No, I agree with him. You know, I think what people have to realize is that rail cars are no longer just hulking metal boxes on wheels. They're highly complex computerized systems that rely on sensors, processors, and connectivity to operate. Computers open and close doors. They monitor passenger behavior. They change the speed and direction of the car. They exchange data with the environment around them. And so having computers perform these functions can result in safer and more efficient rail operations, but only if the cybersecurity risks inherent in relying on those computers are appropriately managed. And I don't see much evidence of that here. You know, I appreciate MBTA's, acknowledgement of the DoD standards, but, you know, having a set of things to comply against is different than kind of feeling cybersecurity in your bones and baking this into your operational practices. Every bit as important is how they oversee this, the implementation of the standards. What will the security posture look like on a day-to-day basis? Who at MBTA is responsible for essentially owning this risk? What are the oversight and accountability mechanisms? All those questions, which are really management questions and about leadership, I haven't seen answers to yet.
Interesting. So, be specific. What are the risks? I mean, is this a risk that Representative Dooley was talking about? They could actually take control of the system. They could hack into it. Are they spying on us? Are they spying on passengers? I mean, be specific. What are the risks here?
Yeah. Well, let's take a step back for a moment from China. And, so these risks would exist no matter where in the world the train is manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously China presents a heightened threat profile due to its pretty extraordinary track record of espionage against the United States. We also are military and economic competitors with China. And so, the China angle matters here, but this is about more than just China. This is about treating cybersecurity risk the same way that you treat safety risks, because cybersecurity threats can give rise to safety threats. So as an example, there's an attack that we've seen become really common over the past few years. It's really hospitals and small businesses have been particularly hard hit, but it's not a stretch to imagine other targets. It's called ransomware. Essentially, an adversary, it could be a nation state, it could be a criminal group, will break into a system and essentially encrypt all the data to make the system unusable unless, the user either pays a bribe or does some other action. I know. So imagine, a criminal group or a nation state threatening or doing this during rush hour, right? The results would be devastating. Mm. From a safety perspective, if an adversary is able to get inside the computers that control traffic management and the speed and direction of the car, they could cause accidents. So these are real risks. And again, what's important here is for MBTA to view cybersecurity risk as a dimension of the broader set of safety risks that I know they really care about.
So my understanding is that there's proposed federal policy which is attached to the appropriations bill tied up by the shutdown right now, and this would put essentially a 1-year restriction on federal money being spent on transit vehicles produced by companies owned or subsidized by the Chinese government, like the new T cars, for instance. That would allow give the Department of Homeland Security time to study the risk. What's the study of that policy right now, of that bill right now?
Yeah, as you referenced, Congress is shut down, just like the broader federal government is. And so, for now, it's obviously not at the top of Congress's agenda, getting the government back open is. And so, I would expect if and when Congress is able to work this out with the White House, that this will come back.
And let me come back to you. I want to just go back to Representative Dooley, because I understand that you filed your own bill in the state legislature to do something similar to the federal proposal, right?
Exactly.
And so what would the bill do?
Basically, what mine was set up was for non-market economy. So that's how the United States and also the UN defines countries like China and North Korea, Iran. Would be prohibited from companies that are substantially owned by non-market economies countries to be exempt from bidding on any Commonwealth.
Exempt or prohibited.
Prohibited.
Prohibited
from bidding on any procurement over $1 million.
So what do you think the state should do right now? I mean, there are a lot of jobs tied up with this. The T needs serious upgrading. This Chinese company can make more cars for less money. They're building them at a plant in Springfield, creating jobs. Would you advocate just stopping that process because of an unproved risk?
Well, I was going to say, we're already in the process of this one. I'm just talking about things going forward.
I think
it's one of these things that we really need to address. And, do we really want to be in bed with the Chinese government, with all their human rights violations and their active espionage going on against Americans and American companies for a few extra dollars? I mean, it's a 20%. They basically bought their business by being 20% as opposed to all the other North American vendors.
Hmm. Andrew Grotto, should we be concerned about all those other products that we use and surround ourselves with in our household that are made in China?
I think what's important to recognize here is that, managing risk is, you tailor the measures you take to mitigate a risk against the threat posed, by a risk. And so the threat from, your TV, going haywire is a lot different and for most people a lot smaller than if the commuter rail system were to go south. And so we would expect, really we ought to demand more protections, more investment for infrastructure, which if it went, if it were damaged, could cause, catastrophic loss of life and economic damage than ordinary consumer goods. But that doesn't mean that we don't, demand more risk mitigation measures for those goods as well. But again, it's easy, look, there are a lot of good reasons to beat China up over its trade policy, over its human rights record, its record of espionage. But these risks are present no matter where a good is manufactured. It could be manufactured in the United States, and it doesn't mean there's no cybersecurity risk.
Right. So, final question. As someone with deep experience in the federal government, do you have confidence, Andrew Grotto, that this problem is being sufficiently recognized and sufficiently reckoned with by the federal government right now?
So I think it's mixed. I know that there are a lot of people in this administration who are dedicated and committed to addressing cyber threats. But as we look ahead at things like privacy, which there'll be a lively debate in this coming Congress on consumer privacy, which is relevant to cybersecurity. A lively debate on infrastructure investment. The country is, by some estimates, $1.5 trillion in the hole on infrastructure investments. I'd like to see them, really make sure that these policy domains that bear on safety consider the cybersecurity risks that embedding more computers, more digital a kit in infrastructure creates for the American people.
Mm. Sean Dooley, last question to you, because you brought this to our attention. Are you confident that the state, that Massachusetts is going to do what it needs to do? So, I guess the sort of follow-up to that question is, where's your bill going?
I was going to say, it's just, just filed yesterday. The bill filing deadline, as you know, is tomorrow. So we'll see. So far, I'm not confident, but I'm going to keep pushing because I think it is a legitimate concern, and we need to at least have the discussion. I'd love to be proven that there's no possibility, and then I'll be happy.
All right. Well, that's Norfolk State Representative Sean Dooley. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks
appreciate it. And Andrew Grotto, former head of cybersecurity policy in the White House under Presidents Obama and Trump, thank you so much for joining us today and helping us with this discussion.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, what do you think about all this? Send us a tweet. Talk to us on Facebook at Radio Boston. And stay with us. Coming up, Attorney General Maura Healey takes on Purdue Pharma and its owners. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's catch up with Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey versus the Sackler family, owners of Purdue Pharma.
I promise you that we will hold opioid makers accountable for the role they played in creating this crisis. We will do whatever it takes to hold this company accountable and to get the justice our families so deserve.
That was Healey speaking yesterday during her inauguration, and she's making good on that promise. In a complaint filed against the company that makes the opioid painkiller OxyContin, Healey alleges that Purdue Pharma and its owners deceived Massachusetts doctors and patients in an effort to get more people to use its drugs, even though they knew the drugs are addictive and deadly. The complaint is the first to name individuals of the Sackler family, which owns Purdue, and it alleges that they and company executives directed misleading sales and marketing practices that influenced doctors to prescribe more opioids to vulnerable patients. WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker has been following this story, and she joins us now. Deb, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Anthony.
So, really serious stuff here. Give us a few more specifics about Healey's complaint.
Well, it's a 274-page complaint, so a lot there. It outlines essentially how the opioid epidemic has affected Massachusetts and why Healey thinks that some members of the Sackler family, some Purdue executives, former executives and former and current board members should be held responsible for promoting OxyContin. Now, the complaint says Purdue sales reps visited Massachusetts prescribers and pharmacists more than 150,000 times between 2007 2018, and that they provided gifts and meals to about 2,000 prescribers in this state, so aggressively selling this drug.
Wow. So how is the Sackler family and the company Purdue responding?
Well, the Sackler family hasn't commented. Purdue Pharma emailed the statement saying that the attorney general's allegations distort the facts. That statement accuses Healey of, quote, cherry-picking information to, quote, bolster inflammatory allegations, and the email response from Purdue Pharma also says that the FDA has addressed many of the issues that Healey has in her complaint, and the FDA, according to this email statement from Purdue, has continued to determine that Purdue's opioids are safe.
So one interesting part of the many interesting parts of the complaint is that it outlines Purdue's relationship with institutions in Massachusetts, here in Massachusetts, including Mass General Hospital, Tufts University. What does it say about how these institutions worked with Purdue Pharma?
Right. These are interesting, Anthony. The complaint says that the Sacklers funded a pain program at MGH, at Mass General Hospital. And the complaint alleges that this pain program allowed Purdue to continue to promote opioids in a deceptive way. It says Purdue planned a symposium at MGH and prepared the guest list so it would include, quote, key politicians. It says the Sacklers supported a program at Tufts. It was a pain research program. It was called the Masters of Science in Pain Research, Education, and Policy program. And Attorney General Healey's complaint says this program was such a success for Purdue that it wanted it to serve as a model for influencing teaching hospitals around the country. So the complaint says Purdue regularly sent staff to Tufts, and it says Tufts even promoted a Purdue employee to adjunct associate professor back in 2011.
So how is Tufts, MGH, these institutions, how are they reacting to
all
this?
Well, we did receive an email from MGH that basically says, referred us to an editorial that was written in 2002, shortly after its pain program with Purdue was launched. And the editorial essentially says Purdue in no way influenced seminars or medical materials about treating pain from MGH. Tufts said it was not going to comment.
Now, what about the defendants' ties here? Members of the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma execs. Talk a little bit about those ties.
Right. Well, some of the board members and former board members and executives have either lived here or currently do live here. So there's a little bit of jurisdiction there in terms of legal action. Many of them have served on boards or have worked for some of the educational and biotech institutions here. So many of these folks do have direct ties to Massachusetts.
Wow. Now, also, an idea of Purdue's footprint here in Massachusetts. How much has the company profited here in terms of sales and revenue from its opioid prescriptions?
Well, the complaint says that Massachusetts sales represented 2.8% of Purdue Pharma revenues. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it says since May of 2007, Purdue has sold more than 70 million doses of opioids in Massachusetts for more than $500 million.
70 million doses. Okay, so what is the state, the AG's office, hoping to get out of this, and what happens next?
Well, this is just one in a series of legal actions over the opioid epidemic. As for Attorney General Healey's complaint, the next hearing on that is scheduled for next week, and it's really a hearing over what information can be released in public documents, in court documents. But there's a lot of litigation here, Anthony. There are more than 100 Massachusetts municipalities that are joined in what's called multi-district litigation. And that is not just communities from Massachusetts, but from around the country. And basically what that litigation does is it alleges that manufacturers like Purdue and opioid distributors, which are even bigger companies, are responsible. So that's litigation against them and pharmacies. The first hearings in that aren't expected until the fall. But, you know, if you're looking for signs of what might happen here, there was an interesting ruling just this month in Connecticut where a judge dismissed lawsuits against Purdue and other drug companies that were brought by some communities in Connecticut. The judge said that the lawsuits were not allowed and because he was going to treat them as regular civil cases, and therefore the lawsuits couldn't survive without proof that the people being sued are directly responsible for the financial losses. So really, Anthony, what we're witnessing here is unprecedented in terms of seeing the judiciary being asked to respond to an enormous current public health crisis.
Wow. Really fascinating story. WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker bringing us up to date. Thanks so much for coming in, Deb. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So let's bring in former federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's WBUR's legal analyst and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, good to have you. Always good to hear you.
Good to be here.
So Massachusetts was the first state to file a lawsuit against Purdue, its executives and owners over their role in the opioid epidemic. And this latest complaint is the first to name individual members of the Sackler family. So is one of the big questions here, what did these people know about their drugs and when did they know it?
I think that is one of the questions. I think it's actually a complicated case. It's not entirely unprecedented because, you know, 20 years ago we saw similar kind of cases against big tobacco. And the question was, you know, they acting like an ordinary commercial company wanted to increase their sales. Did they increase their sales at a price of public health? What was the responsibility of individual smokers versus the companies that were pushing cigarettes on everyone? That's the model here. And in multiple states then sued big tobacco companies saying you were responsible for the public health crisis. That's the analog here. Healey is saying you, Purdue Pharma, are responsible for this public health crisis. There are cases around the country that are in federal court and have been consolidated into one case in Ohio. So these have been all across the country. I think that Maura Healey's case is the first, one of the first freestanding state cases, and in particular, naming the Sackler family.
And what's the significance of that, of naming members of the family? In other words, does it make the case different than if it was just a case against the company?
Well, you know, whenever you put a name and a face on a claim of misconduct, it certainly makes a difference. The accusations are certainly stunning, and they talk about sort of the emails that the company say Healy cherry picked are emails in which Richard Sackler is calling people and trying to pump up sales. Now, you got to pause for a minute, though. All drug companies pump up sales.
I was going to ask you that. I mean, isn't this sort of consistent with the way drug companies, all of them, operate?
Right. So there's no question that everyone is trying to pump up sales. The issue is whether or not they are doing it when they know the risks, doing it with respect to categories of people whose when they're taking the drug is particularly risky. And that's the issue here, to the elderly, to people who are in chronic pain and were bound to take large amounts over a long period of time. In the past, opioids had been more short-term. Were they trying to suggest, you know, that this was that you could avoid addiction with long-term use? So the devil is going to be in the details.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, so would the defense, one defense that Purdue and the Sackler family could use against this complaint was, we certainly know now about the addictive qualities of these drugs, but we just simply didn't know then. So then it gets back to this idea of what did you know and when did you know it?
That's right. And it's a question of time. I mean, the scope of the crisis became more and more clear in recent months. Were they doing, even at an earlier time, more than what the science supported? Were they minimizing, trivializing the risks of addiction when, in fact, they were clearly high? Were they saying, for example, in the Healy complaint, you know, that if there was an addiction, it was the fault of the patient, not the fault of doctors who were encouraged to give ever, you know, long-term usage of opioids? So I think that the devil will be in the details here.
Yeah. And if it does come down to whether company officials knew that their drugs were dangerous and addictive at the time they were trying to pump up sales, I mean, how does that get investigated? In other words, how do the states prove that?
Well, the states prove it, again, tobacco is the model here. Mm. The states get discovery. You get, and now in this, you know, email world, you'll get emails from people, and you'll have to map that against what the company was actually doing. What were the sales plans like? Were there targets that were set that then enabled people or encouraged people to prescribe more or in ways that they shouldn't have? I mean, there are ways of addressing this.
Right. Now, in its statement, Purdue Pharma, as we've made reference to, said that Attorney General Healy cherry-picked from among tens of millions of emails and other business documents produced by Purdue, unquote. And they said that the complaint, therefore, is biased and inaccurate. Is that a pretty serious accusation for them to make? Is that the basis of a pretty credible defense, if they can sort of talk about why that's significant, cherry-picking out of tens of millions of emails?
Well, that's advocacy. Yeah, you call it cherry-picking. I call it advocacy. That's what lawyers do.
Yeah.
Lawyers take the best information and they, you know, put it in a line and then they say it makes this case. I suppose that if there's an email that says, you know, increase your sales amongst the elderly, and then the next one says, but be sure to warn them about opioid addiction, then that will have been wrongly and misrepresentatively cherry-picked. If you don't have that kind of pattern, you draw a different kind of conclusion.
Yeah.
So I think I that's not an impressive response, except to say what they're really saying by that is, we're going to have an answer to this.
Right.
We'll have an answer. The answer will be, that's not all he said, or that's not all he did, or we didn't know of the dangers. There'll be an answer to it. That's all that was suggesting. It's a placeholder comment for the answer that's to come.
Interesting. So let me ask you another thing that we heard from Deb Becker, that MGH and Tufts were named as having worked with Purdue Pharma, and the complaint alleges that MGH's pharma pain program was funded by the company. It alleges that the Sacklers supported a master's program they started at Tufts centered around pain research, education, and policy. What does this mean for these institutions? Could they end up being sort of sucked into this case in some way?
Well, they could, but, you know, again, looking at this from, you know, 80,000 feet up, many, many programs at many hospitals around the country are funded by companies. And they clearly have an interest in the way the funding, the companies have an interest in maximizing their sales. The issue is how independent the institution is so that the funding source doesn't determine what it is they say. In other words, if the MIT or the Tufts program recognized the history, you know, the dangers of addiction and brought that to the attention of the company, or whether or not their positions were skewed by who the funders were. That's a really, that's a serious question, and it's sort of endemic in the way we fund much research in this country.
Boy. Well, fascinating case. I have a feeling we're going to be talking about it for some time to come. Former federal judge Nancy Gertner, she's WBUR's legal analyst and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Nancy, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and get your expertise on these legal matters.
Thank you.
And thanks again to WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zuckoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Satesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.